We're doing Kedoshim, Perek Yud Tes, that's 19, Pasuk Tes Vav, which is 15. Lo Sasu Avel B'Mishpat. You should not practice crookedness in justice, which Rashi says is a warning to the judge. The corruption of justice from the standpoint of those who are entrusted to carry out justice. That is to say, the judges, the court. Now, Avel itself implies perversion. And Rashi makes a point of that. Comes to teach us that the judge who distorts, who corrupts the din is called Avel. A perversion. Which implies sonui, it's hated, mishukats, disgusting, cherem, it's something which is banished, v'televa, an abomination. And he goes on to prove the point that the term avel, it has this connotation of something which is sonui, which is hated, which is hateful. Which is disgusting. Rashi's telling us that when the Torah chose the word Avel, it's for a reason. It's trying to communicate something. The question that we're asking is that the Pasuk is warning us against injustices, against the distortion of justice, corruption of justice, from those who have the greatest capacity to destroy justice, obviously, which would be the court system. Because the entire implementation of justice is dependent upon the integrity of the judges, of the court system. So therefore, if there's any kind of a breakdown at that point in the judges, it's not just an individual phenomenon, it destroys the whole system. My question is, why is it referring to it as Avel? Rashi makes a point. There's a whole Rashi over there explaining the significance of the term Avel, that it's connected to things that are referred to as an abomination, as yeshekets, things that are disgusting, and so forth. And there must be an idea behind that. Well, it could merely have said that one shouldn't practice injustice, simply. Or one shouldn't distort justice. But by using this term, it's communicating something. Question is, what is it communicating? We're going to proceed now, and hopefully we'll come back to this point. So it starts off by admonishing the judges not to do anything which would corrupt the system of justice. Lo sisa pnei dal, you should not show favor to the poor man. Velo sedar pnei gadol, nor should you give honor to a great man. It starts off with a general admonition, and then it goes to particulars. And they seem to be diametrically opposed. Because first it starts off by mentioning one type of a distortion, which has to do with the dull, with the destitute. And then there's another one, which seems to be the exact opposite. It seems to be warning us against any kind of favoritism. That's one of the elements which corrupts justice, the favoritism. Mishpat has to be blind. You can't favor anybody. You can't be concerned about this particular or that particular. You just have to be involved in the mishpat. And so to speak, let the chips fall where they may. But that's the idea of distortion. That's the major element of distortion, is that a person enters mishpat with a preconceived agenda. Preconceived could be on many, many levels, interestingly enough. It could be something which is conscious, which is overt. The person has already taken a bribe. The fix is in. That's for sure. But that's obvious. Everybody understands that. What the Pasuk is pointing out is that there are much more subtle things that that intervene. And this Pasuk is telling you that anything that a judge cannot look at this case from the standpoint of any type of outcome. That is, when the case is presented to him, his mind cannot be diverted. He can't have any kind of consideration of the outcome, that is to say, the effects of what I'm going to be doing. The judge cannot take into consideration the effects of what I'm going to be doing. That, I think, is the most fundamental idea. That he realizes, anyone that's in that position, a case comes before him, so he understands that there's going to be consequences to the decision, to the outcome. And those consequences can be beneficial, and that they can be hurtful or painful. Thus, he has enormous power at his discretion. He's in a position of tremendous power in terms of affecting people's lives. And those types of things are of concern. He'll start to think about them. That is, he can realize that the nature of the case in front of him, there are cases where one person is suing another person, and they could be suing for $50 million and so forth if they're successful, so they can completely bankrupt the other person. And then beyond that, he'll owe money for the rest of his life, can destroy his life. So, therefore, that's human nature, there's a tendency, I mean, everybody has that, to consider the effects of what I'm going to be doing. And the Torah over here seems to be directing itself at that impulse to consider what the effects will be. And it's pointing out two categories of how a judge might be affected by the consideration of the effects. Now, on the surface, they seem to be opposites. So let's analyze each one. What's the phenomenon of giving recognition to the dull, to the destitute? Take a look at Rashi. Rashi says, Shelo tomar anihu. You shouldn't say this person is an ani. Ani who's there. This person is ani. They are ashir, chayav lefarnaso. So Rashi is saying, presupposing a case in which you have a poor man against a rich man, which is very interesting, because the second part of the puzzle seems to be talking about the other emotion, and that is to show honor to the wealthy man. But here, we're talking about rich man, poor man, and we're concerned that the judge will want to favor the poor man. And you'll, what's the idea? What's the emotion? You'll say that he's an ani, and the wealthy person is obligated to support him. As I can, but then, so I will acquit him in din. V'nimtza misparnes b'nikius. And it'll turn out that he's supported in a legitimate way. That is, he doesn't have to go for charity. It's interesting to note that Rashi here is not just pointing out that a person might be swayed by a certain emotion, an emotion of sympathy for the poor, for the plight of the poor person. But, according to Rashi, he's saying that that this person will have a justification, that he'll rationalize. So, of course, that makes it worse, because activities, wrongdoings, which lend themselves to rationalization, are always more difficult to deal with. But what's very interesting is that within the framework of the rationalization, the type of rationalization that he gives is one which is based on the Torah. Because he's saying that the usher is chayev lefarnasah, that according to the Torah he has a chiyuv. So basically what he's doing is he's assisting. In other words, after all is said and done, what's emerging is something which is correct. It is correct that the wealthy person should be supporting the poor person. So therefore, I'm effectuating something which is correct according to the Torah. What's interesting is that most people would not regard this type of a person as being evil or wicked or an abomination. That is to say, this person seems to be, what he's doing may be wrong, of course, it is wrong, it's very seriously wrong, but I'm saying the attitude most people would have is that he's not such a bad person. this is a far cry. I mean, we made a point before that Rashi is stressing that the Torah is using the word avel, and that the word has so many connotations of abomination. And the first instance, it doesn't seem to be that terrible a thing. That is, people, intelligent people would say, look, you can't do that. It's not the right way to go about it. But we understand, we appreciate your motives. That's how most people would view such a thing. And then you'd find many people that would admire him and would agree. When you hear about such a thing, a sophisticated person, an intelligent person will say it's wrong. But you won't get outraged. It's not the typical case you have in mind when you think about judicial corruption, where a judge took a bribe and defrauded somebody, it caused somebody to lose their whole fortune. It's not at all. Yeah, it doesn't have any benefit to the judge. It doesn't seem to have that much of an effect upon the usher either, because what he's saying is correct. The usher is obligated to help him, and it doesn't even seem that the usher is being bankrupted. We're not talking about something like that. It could be a case where it doesn't really hurt him. Because what is a wealthy person doing in a litigation with a destitute person? Can't be that major a thing. Doesn't seem to be that kind of thing. So probably it's an amount which may not be of no significance to the wealthy person. So therefore, the attitude, the emotion of the judge is going to be very much in favor, inclined towards the poor person. And he may take a look at this and say, this whole case is ridiculous. This thing shouldn't be here altogether. No matter what the reality is, even if the poor person is wrong and he owes the money to the wealthy person, but the whole thing is absurd because the wealthy person should give him this money to sustain him. Why is this case happening? In this society, I guarantee you, this judge would be a hero. Because this type of phenomenon is very prevalent in our society today, where you have this idea that the many judges, when they deal with a case, they abandon the strict interpretation of the law. And they utilize the system to provide a certain type of social justice. That the system is being used to bring about certain results which they have decided are socially beneficial. And, of course, there are judges that argue against that philosophy and so forth, but certainly nobody looks at the judges who try to use the system for social justice, or they allow that to enter into the decision-making process. What the outcomes, the utilization of outcome, these people are not condemned. In many cases, they're on the Supreme Court, and they're highly admired people. There are others that disagree with their approach, but nobody that would regard them as being an abomination. We're going to move on now to the third part of the pasuk, or the second category. For lo sedar pnei gadol, you should not give honor to the face of the gadol. Well, then there's a further idea. But tzedek tishpot amitecha. With tzedek, with justice, with righteousness shall you judge your nation. What is the second case? Rashi v'lo sedar p'nei gadol, shelo toma osher huzeh. You shouldn't say this person is a wealthy man. Ben gadolim huzeh, or he's the son of gadolim. Interesting. Of course, we understand the first case. Everybody has a certain tendency to show favor to the wealthy person. Everybody wants to be on his good side. But it mentions something else. So that we could see is more of a corruption. Because that shows that your values, that materialism and the wealthy person are impressed by that. But it also mentions another possibility for this type of flattery. And that is Ben Gadolim. He's the son of Gedolim, of great people. Yeah, that means that you have a certain respect for who he comes from. His father was a big Talmud Chacham or a great man. It's not just wealth. So that's something which you want, which is deserving of respect. Well, even a wealthy person is deserving of a certain respect. But we don't look at a wealthy person in terms of respect in the same light as a gadol. So here, it's even something which is more noble, that the judge wants to show honor to this person because of his lineage. He wants to show respect to the people from whom he comes. So that's the second. So Rashi gives you two alternatives as to why the gadol, the judge, might want to show favor to the gadol. Then again, he comes up with something which seems a little bit compelling. Heich avayshenu. How can I embarrass this person? The era bevishto, and I will just stand by and observe his embarrassment. So, onesh yesh bedava. That's liable to punishment, to allow somebody to be embarrassed. L'kach ne'amar v'lo sedar p'nei gadol. Therefore, the Torah said, lo sedar p'nei gadol. You shouldn't show honor. It's very interesting. You see from this that the Torah is not just addressing simplistic cases, but it's addressing cases where there's powerful compulsions, powerful, compelling forces that could lead a judge to tilt in a certain direction. And even in this case, you see the emotion. Rashi points out the emotion. That is, what the issue is, the concern in terms of the outcome, in terms of the results, and the justification, the rationalization. Both cases contain that rationalization. Because we're assuming that the judge is sophisticated. He's not just someone that's going to follow his emotions. And the emotions themselves aren't the problem. The problem is that the emotions create the rationalizations. And these, in both cases, these are very powerful rationalizations which find support in terms of the Torah. That is, here he's saying, it's wrong. According to the Torah, I'm going to be embarrassing someone. And you know, I don't embarrass someone. So, therefore, how could I do it? Just want to read, with regard to the particularities, the specifics in terms of the halacha that pertain to this prohibition of sedar p'nei gadol. Now, one shouldn't think that the case that Rashi is giving is the only illustration. Rashi is giving you sort of the worst case scenario. That is to say, a case... See, Rashi is taking lo sedar p'nei gadol and lo sisa p'nei dol. Rashi is taking that as illustrations of the Sasu Ovel Bamishpat, where the Torah, on the literal level, is talking about real corruption of justice, where the justice per se is perverted. However, the particularities that the pasuk is outlining over here does not necessarily, in other words, you can have a violation of these two things, even without a distortion of justice, in terms of the result. Let me explain. The Rambam, lo sedar p'nei gadol, asur lahadir p'nei gadol. It is prohibited to honor a gadol. Ketzad, harei shebo lefanecha shnayim ledin echad. Excuse me, shnayim ledin. If two people come before you for judgment, Echad Chacham, one is a Chacham, a scholar, Chacham Gadol, a great scholar, V'Echad Hedyot, and the other person's an ignoramus. All right, so you're ready, you can see the situation. You have a certain attitude towards the scholar, and you have a different attitude towards the ignoramus. Lotakdim Lishol B'Shlomo Shel Gadol. You cannot act, friend, in other words, to first go and greet. You can't greet the gadol first. V'lo tazbir lo panim. You can't show him any face. That is to say that we're talking about subtle things over here. Before you actually get down to business, so then there's the social amenities, the greetings. And in that seemingly trivial business, therein, right at that point in time, the Torah is prohibiting. You can't show any kind of treatment to the gadol, as opposed to the ignoramus. V'lo sechabdenu, you can't give him kavod. Why? Kidei shelo yistatnu tainosav shel achar. So that the other person should not be stifled. That's a very interesting psychological observation. Well, when a person comes to court, especially if he's not really a powerful, prestigious individual, so there's a very, very strong intimidation factor. And whether or not he can proceed successfully is going to be dependent to a large extent on the reception. Right off the bat, you walk in, the other guy is received, he's honored, he's treated, so right away it conveys a certain feeling. It increases the intimidation. And when a person's intimidated, he really can't argue properly. He already feels that he's defeated already. But he really cannot turn to either one of them until the matter is complete. Now he quotes what Rashi quotes. Altomar Oshir Huzeh Ben Gedolin Huzeh. He quotes the Chazal that say you shouldn't say this person's wealthy, he's the son of Gedolin. Heich Avayshenu Ve'era Bevushaso. It's interesting. The Rambam is citing the exact same Chazal as Rashi, but they're not using it for the same purposes. Because Rashi is not talking about the treatment that you give. While we can recognize that it's wrong, again, it doesn't seem to be that terrible a thing. Because it's preliminary to the actual case. We're not even talking about the trying of the case. We're talking about how you greet them when they come into the court. That's what the Rambam is citing as the halacha. Rashi cites that same Chazal, but Rashi is doing it to create the impression that you're going to overturn the case. It's quite a different thing. That is, in Rashi, the outcome is that you distort the case. And you rule in favor of the wealthy person. It would seem that that's what Rashi's saying. The Rambam is not saying that. So according to Rashi, we understand what the Avla is. There's really Ivus Mishpat. There's a distortion of the din, of the justice. But according to the Rambam, it's not necessarily the case. Because it could turn out that your judgment is a correct judgment, according to the Rambam. The reason I understand Rashi that way is because Rashi doesn't specify these factors, that you're just showing him a little bit more honor in the greeting. Rashi just quoting the Chazal and telling you that's the problem over here, and it's following after the first case of showing favor to the poor. In showing favor to the poor, specifically Rashi is saying you show favor to him by ruling in his favor, to see to it that he should win. Thus, we have to conclude that in the second case, that's the emotion. The fear of embarrassing the wealthy person leads you to rule in his favor. And that's not what the Rambam has said. Because the Rambam didn't say whether you rule in his favor or don't rule in his favor. The Rambam merely said that you treat the person a certain way. In terms of understanding the pasuk, Rashi is easier to understand. Because that's something that we recognize as a corruption when there's a distortion of the justice. In the other case, it may not be correct and so on and so forth, but shouldn't we say, well, let's see what happens. Let's see whether the person judges correctly. If he judges correctly, so then what's the difference? There's no argument between Rashi and the Rambam. Rashi would agree with the Rambam. And everybody agrees that these laws are included under these headings of showing favor. However, the Rashi is telling you how to understand the sense of the pasuk. In terms of the plain pshat of the pasuk, the plain pshat of the pasuk is talking about a real corruption of the justice of the outcome, based upon two different types of emotions with their rationalizations, which could affect the judge. I would say that the underlying issue over here, and this is a determinative phenomenon, this determines the status of the person, the level of the person, is that he abandons the course, the derech of mishpat, which is emes, which is the truth. He abandons that in favor of a particular emotion. He's overcome by a particular emotion which is based upon a certain attachment to some emotional objective. And therein lies the whole corruption. That is the toeva. that is being spelled out. Of course, in general, we're talking about a judge who consciously corrupts the system of justice. That's Toeva. Because the reason that he's doing it is because it shows that he's steeped in the value of materialism, that the essence is materialism for him. And everything else that he's doing, all the knowledge he's acquired, and even the position of being a judge, is all secondary, is all swept aside whenever he's overcome by his attachment to the material. So that's the Toeva. The fact that the person recognizes the material as being the ultimate. For him, that's the ultimate reality. But then it goes on into other cases. In these two cases, for the first case, it's not that he's pursuing materialism. He's not getting bribed. It's a poor man. But it means to say that over here, he's allowing his emotions to overcome him to the extent that his attitudes in terms of what's right and what's wrong are being determined by his emotions. And that's the Toeva. That's another expression of Toeva, of an abomination. That I was just discussing this recently. I mean, that is to say that the people that deny God, people that deny that the source, the ultimate source of the universe, and they just maintain the things that just exist, whatever, by accident. So there's no basis then for any right or any wrong. How do they live? Everybody has to live with a sense of right and wrong, and all these people are crusaders. They have causes, morality, immorality, justice, injustice. I mean, it's absolutely absurd. On what basis is it? The whole world is an accident. There can't be anything which is right. There can't be anything which is wrong. There's no basis. There's no ultimate reality in which it defines. And yet these people operate with these categories. Where do these categories come from? So basically what you're saying is, because bottom line, because that's how they feel. They feel that the mistreating animals is wrong. Or they feel that not helping the homeless is wrong. But that's just your feeling. There's no basis objectively. But nevertheless, that does not prevent them from being absolutely convinced and the crusading and willing to go to war for these things, which are basically all it means to say is that's how you feel about something. So it's the worship of your own feelings.
What do I mean?
That's an absolute evil. When a person's on a level where all of his ideas and principles and behaviors are purely based upon his own arbitrary feelings. Instead of an objective system. And that's the whole idea of the Torah, that a person has to recognize that right and wrong and how things should be in this world cannot be based upon a person's feelings. They have to be based upon an objective system of right and wrong, of truth. And anything, and that's why the whole system was set up, the whole system of Mishpat is set up in order that things should be governed in accordance with the objective system of truth. And once a person distorts that, because of any cause, whatever the cause may be, some people it's money, they want to promote themselves. And some people it's a certain social agenda. For some people it's a certain emotion. Whatever it is an abandonment of the course of truth, of living in accordance with an objective system of reality in favor of a subjective emotional attitude. That's the abomination. The ultimate corruption is where it manifests itself with rationalizations. That's the worst thing of all, because as long as he doesn't rationalize, it's not so bad. Because the person is doing something wrong, he has strong emotions, but there's also, he's contending with the objective truth. He recognizes that what he's doing is wrong. But where a person takes the next step and is able to manipulate and to say that this is really the outcome that the Torah desires. That may be true that this is the outcome, but not in this way. Not in this way. The method that you're bringing it about is really a destructive way. The worst avla that we faced in history, the worst the corruptions, and not just that people had emotions, and because of their emotions, they didn't follow the Torah. That's one category, but that's not the most harmful. The most harmful is where, as a result of their emotions, they sought to distort the Torah, to utilize the Torah. They're utilizing the Torah as a means of achieving their objectives. So they try to find proofs within the system of the Torah. That's basically what the Christians do. That's basically what the Reform Jews do today. And that is that they become the arbiters. And they come out with all these positions that are contrary to Torah, but then they seek to find the proof for it within the Torah. Now you see that this is the ideal of the Torah. You see, this type of reasoning, they could justify gay marriages because they'll find, you know, that the objective of the Torah that people should find fulfillment and whatever kind of nonsense they'll bring up. They root it in generalized types of Torah values. The same thing with these people that claim that vegetarianism is the ultimate ideal. So they'll talk about the planet and that cruelty to animals and so on and so forth. It's all distortion. It's not the truth. It's not the specific derech that the Torah gave over to man and how to achieve these objectives. It's a distortion. So the first line of defense in terms of distortion would be the system of tzedek. But tzedek tishpot amisecha, that the approach has to be that the people have to be governed in accordance with mishpat, as which is not just general ideals but a specific system as to how these ideals are implemented and what the law should be in this case and what the law should be in this case, how it is to be established, how it is to be brought about. In many instances, it will not appear as justice to you. Because when you look at justice, you're not looking at pure justice. You're looking at justice with many, many factors. Man looks at it in terms of the outcome, in terms of the poor person, in terms of the embarrassment. There the Torah is telling you that's not part of justice. That's a value, and it's an ideal, but it cannot be achieved in this way. It has to be achieved in a different way. And that's the whole idea of B'tzedek Tishbot Amisecha, that a person has to discipline himself to live in accordance with the system of Tzedek, of Mishpat, that God has decreed for us. What exactly constitutes Mishpat in any given case? And that's the basic idea, that when that you could fit the Rambam in. You could fit the Rambam in. And you could understand why the Rambam is making such a significant thing out of what seems to be trivial. Who do you greet? Who do you show more a favor to? It means to say that when a judge is sitting in judgment, he's in a completely different framework. He has to remove himself from any social framework. Because as long as he's in the social framework, he has certain emotions. He's a human being like everybody else. And any human being, no matter how great he is, once he enters into the realm of the social, it's a social framework. So he's friendly to this one, and he wants to be kind to the other person. He wants the poor person to be taken care of. All kinds of social phenomena. What the Torah is saying is that Mishpat is a completely different realm. And it's a realm, that's why it's in the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You see that the witnesses, when they testify, have to be standing. That's considered to be in the presence of God, in the Shekhinah. So therefore, when a person gets involved in judgment, he has to free himself from all of these factors, which is basically rooted in the human approach towards the area. That's man's approach. And man's approach is not a pure approach. Man's approach is an admixture of a certain amount of justice, a certain amount of reason, a certain amount of emotion, a certain amount of compassion. It's a mishmash. It's an admixture. And the Dayan has to completely free himself from any type of social impulses, no matter what they are, and put himself in a completely different framework, like he's Omeid Lifnei Hamakom. And therefore, the Rambam is saying that even no ordinary greetings. As soon as they come in, you can't recognize faces. That's the whole idea of recognizing faces. There's no recognition. People lose their identities. When you're sitting in justice, people come in, it's like they don't have any names, they don't have identities, they don't have backgrounds, they are not, it's not the so-and-so, this wealthy guy. It's as opposed to so-and-so, the poor guy. No. You just have two individuals, and each one has a case, and your objective is to completely disassociate yourself from any social context. And it's like a scientist who's just in the lab and he's purely interested in following the natural course, and he doesn't know what the outcome is and he doesn't care what the outcome is. He just wants to pursue it to the outcome. Any deviation from that, that's where the Rambam makes the point, that as soon as he begins to act towards an individual in a certain way, he's bringing the social into the picture. And that is the avla. That is the corruption. And that is the abomination. Let me just clarify. When the Rambam says that if you show favor towards the wealthy person, so the poor person will be stifled and won't make his claims properly. Obviously, it means to say that this kind of behavior is one which can affect the process. It doesn't necessarily have to. But the Rambam wants to show you, we're not just talking about something which is not going to have any bearing on the case. That is to say, if this were something, if this type of behavior would not have any effect, would not cause any stifling, so then it wouldn't be prohibited, because it would be unrelated to this prosecution of the case. But the Rambam is trying to tell you that since there is a connection, it might have some kind of an effect, even though you come to the true conclusion, it doesn't matter. It means to say that you cannot engage in any kind of behaviors which will have the effect of distorting the justice. That's what the Rambam says.